Already I'm seeing heads. No. When a man knows a woman? When a man knows a woman? When a man knows a woman? This will be a fun game. Maybe I should ask one of these guys who was shaking his head like this to complete that sentence. When a man knows a woman.
The dude aren't even look at me.
That's a good way to complete that sentence, okay. When a man knows a woman, anything? There are no men present who apparently have any knowledge of women. That's their story, and they're sticking to it. Well, when I grew up, I just remember hearing this as a kid. I would hear people talk about it. I would hear the adults say, well, he knew her in the biblical sense. And there was always kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, nudge. Say no more. And I was a kid. I was like, what? And then, you know, somewhere along the line, maybe around the age of confirmation, I read in the Bible, and Adam knew Eve, and she bore him a son. Oh, you mean knew her in the biblical sense. This is one of the things that we learn about knowledge, biblical knowledge. To know someone in the Bible, to know someone biblically, right? It could be that sort of birds and bees knowing that I discovered. What they were talking about. I did discover it too eventually. But it also means intimacy. When a man knows a woman, we might say, biblically, there is an intimate relationship. I think that's the bottom line, biblically speaking, when a man knows a woman. I came up with that sermon title before I left for vacation almost 2 weeks ago. as I read this, and really, the part where Jesus knows the woman really isn't what part of what Don read. The story goes on. I'll read it here in a minute. But I realized as I was reading the part that I chose, there's 50 verses here that are assigned for today, and I spared you. You're welcome. You're welcome. Reading from 5 to 52. This is very much the way John writes in his gospel. You could hold John in one hand and Mark in the other. Mark is very much he writes memos, right? He gives you bullet points. John is more of a philosopher, and he loves to write, and he loves his words, and he says in 52 words what Mark might have said in 5. But in the second half of that story, and again, like I said, I'll read some of that here in a minute, we really get to the sense that Jesus knew this woman. In the first half, what I see is how she really knew him, right? And I love some of these comments that she makes, and I'm going to start with one. So he asked her for one of my favorite lines, give me a drink. She's like, wow, okay, yes, sir. Not uncommon for his day. What was uncommon, and she points it out here, and you know, why are you, a Jew, asking me, a Samaritan, for a drink? And it says, you know, John gives us a little parenthetical inside information. Jews and Samaritans didn't talk to each other. Well, the other thing that would not happen is a man would not address a strange woman in public, especially if her husband was not present or some man in her life was not present. But she doesn't say, you know, so she zeroes in on the fact that she's Samaritan and he's Jewish. Doesn't zero in on the fact that he's male and she's female. It's like, I think we figured that part out ourselves. Did you guys figure that out? Okay, good. I'm proud of you. the birds and the bees thing just is not missed on you at all, is it? But then she says, or he says, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. And here's what I find to be the insightful piece of her information. She says, sir, you have no bucket, and the well is deep. Isn't that a great line? Sir, you have no bucket. You could take that like, are you stupid? You think you're going to give me water? But really, I think about this, and the way John's writing, John always writes with sort of a double entendre. There's always a deeper meaning. And sometimes, you know, she's having one conversation and he's having another. Same thing with Jesus and Nicodemus when, you know, about being born again. Jesus is having one conversation and Nicodemus is down here on another level. And the woman and the man in this story, Jesus and the woman, it's almost like they're having two different conversations. But you could read into it that she really has a deeper understanding, like the well is deep. That could just be a professor of the obvious statement, you know, did you notice the well is deep? But she could be talking about some other sense of depth that she perceives in Jesus. He doesn't even have a bucket, and yet the well is deep. It just almost feels like she knows who he is. And then she asks some questions. Her questions are good and insightful as well. Like, why are you asking me a drink? And then she says, are you greater than our ancestor Jacob? If I asked you that question, is he greater than our ancestor Jacob? Is that a good question to ask about who Jesus is? Isn't that an interesting question? Is he greater? That's been our answer. That's been the church's answer for thousands of years. Yeah, he is greater. And by the well is deep. And he has no bucket. And yes, he's greater than our ancestor, Jacob. Again, this is emblematic of the way John writes and who Jesus is throughout John's gospel. He continually sort of is paired or compared and contrasted with Jewish heritage, festivals, rituals, practices. An example would be the wedding at Cana. They run out of water, or they run out of wine, right? And what does Jesus do? He turns water into wine. I knew I liked this guy when I read that story. He changed water into wine. Not just any water. There were seven large containers, and it almost, I think, I forget the math in it, but it's enough to fill up a baptistry. It's not just pitchers of water. It's like bathtubs full of water. That's how much. And they were there, and it says, John says, and they were there for the ritual purification of the Jews. And what Jesus does in that story is he himself sort of replaces, he redefines Jewish ritual, and he changes it. He transforms it into something else. Again, this is a sign of who Jesus is in John's gospel. He takes the old and turns it around and makes it something new. And so here he is at this well with this woman. And the well has heritage connected with it. It's Jacob's well. There's a weighty significance to what this place is. You know, places in Jewish lore are significant. Not unlike Native American, you know, there are places that are just significant because of the sacredness of the place. Well, we can attach that same sort of sacredness to the well. This is Jacob's well. This is not just any well. This is not just the town supply of water. This is Jacob's well. And Jesus transforms it into something new. He says, I will give you living water. And later, Jesus says, whoever is thirsty, let them come to me and drink, and I will become for them a source of living water. I will gush up within them. That's in John 7, again, a couple of chapters later. So who Jesus is in this story, as John tells it, is so important. So let me read on a little bit. When a man knows a woman. So she said her last thing was, he said, sir, give me this water, so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here again to draw water. And Jesus said to her, go, call your husband and come back. And the woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you are right in saying I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true. And the woman said to him, "Sir, I see that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that this place, that the place where people must worship is in Jerusalem." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will worship, and you will worship the Father neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. For salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and now is here when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father seeks such as these to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth." And if those words sound familiar, it's because they were part of our call to worship, our opening words today. So I meant to play another little game with you, and that is to see, here's our woman at the well. Tell me what we know about this woman at the well. What do you know about her? Okay, she's a Samaritan. So we know certain things that she's a Samaritan, that sort of comes with some background knowledge too, right? That Samaritans and Jews don't mix. We know the story of the Good Samaritan, and what makes that story so radical is that Samaritans were always seen as the bad guy. In that story, he's the good guy. So she's a Samaritan. She's a woman. What else do we know about her? We now know that she had five husbands, and the one she has now is not her husband. What do we know about that? And I want to caution us here, because we've assumed a lot of things about this woman. Maybe you've heard a lot of sermons about this woman. I've probably preached a few. I don't think I've ever done this to this extent, but it's interesting. I saw Lee, my pastor colleague out at Women at the Well, which is why Margot gave me this. She thought it reminded her of the woman at the well. She preached on this last Thursday, and I just saw a Facebook post about what she said. And, you know, we always do a children's sermon out there at the Women at the Well. And and part of her children's sermon was asking the women there, what do you know about her? Is she good or is she bad? And almost unanimously they all agreed, well, she's bad. Why would we make that assumption that she's bad? Because we've heard a lot of preaching about her, for one thing. I had it, not this Bible, but I was looking at a Bible at home that's got little commentary in it, and it refers to her as a promiscuous woman. We've read this woman's story with glasses on. We put on our morality glasses, some of us, and there's been preaching, and that Bible is a good example. We've put words on her that really Jesus didn't put on. He didn't call her promiscuous. He didn't comment on her morality. He didn't even seem to care that she'd been married five times. Right? You've been to churches that it matters if you've been married more than once. And some of us have been asked to leave churches if we've been married more than once. Jesus doesn't have that. He doesn't put any sort of moral judgment on her. Why would we do that? It's misogyny is what it is. And the church has a history of it. And I'm here to sort of call us out on that a little bit. And so was Lee, and that was her point of that. Why might she be married five times? You know, I've been married a few times. thank you for laughing at that. That is fun. But, you know, in my marriages, the fact that I've been married a few times says something about me, maybe. But it doesn't even come close to explaining, you know, her to be married. Why would she be married five times? Woo! Okay. We really don't know, but there's a cultural practice here. Here's one reason why. if she was a widow, and she probably was widowed many times, very common, right? I mean, the life expectancy just wasn't what it is now. And the custom here was, if you died childless, so she were a childless widow, she would be married to her husband's brother. Well, why would they do that? so that he could produce a male heir. For her. They're looking out for her well-being, right? Because to be without a male heir is to be dependent on the whole community. So it was in the whole community's best interest to make sure she gets married. So here she is, and she's been passed around, quite literally, not necessarily sexually, but certainly she's been treated like property, right? She's been passed around from husband to husband in a system that's asking of her to produce a male heir so that she is not a burden to the community. It's a messed up system. Thank God we don't have that anymore. but why do we have thousands of years of preaching about her as though she's promiscuous and she's a prostitute, and some people have called her a whore. She's living with a guy now. Why would she be living with a guy now? Well, same reason. not necessarily taking a husband, but she's dependent on a man that she lives with. Because that was part, it's just how the rules of the game worked back then. so when a man knows a woman like Jesus seems to know her, without judgment, right, without moral condemnation, he knows her as a human being. Maybe he has even extra compassion on her because she's been passed around like some kind of property or some kind of problem that needs to be solved by the community. He doesn't see her that way. He sees her as a woman, as a human being, as somebody who has a certain thirst. And he sees her as someone who can drink from the fountain of life. She's just like all of us in that sense. And what she represents is human thirst. I love the way Mary Oliver says it. I woke with the thirst for the goodness I do not have. Maybe that's how she woke up that day. That's all she wants, is the goodness that she lacks. And maybe she walks to the well and she finds in Jesus somebody who has deep knowledge. And she says, I see that you're a prophet. And she goes on, and here's where it really gets interesting. I didn't read quite this far. After Jesus says this about worship and God as spirit and truth, the woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, who is called the Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to us. Jesus just talked about worshiping in spirit and truth, and she sort of associates that with, well, yeah, there's going to be this Messiah, and we will be in spirit and truth then. And Jesus answers her. He says to her, guess what he says? He just says two words. My Bible puts it into three words, but he says, I am. The Bible translates it, the text here translates, I am he, the one who is speaking to you. But what is he saying when he says, I am? He's pronouncing the name of God, right? She's a Samaritan, maybe she wouldn't have known that, but the name for God is I am that which I will be. Or I will be that which I will be. Yahweh. Rarely spoken by Hebrews because it's so sacred. And John's gospel is going to go on to include all of these I am saying. I am the bread of life. I am the resurrection. I am the good shepherd. Right? I am the vine. I am the resurrection and the life. His answer is simply I am. She knows. She expects. She anticipates some Messiah. He simply responds with, I am. And in that moment, I have to wonder if she finds the goodness that she's been lacking and perhaps thirsting for. I am. I am. The spirit and the truth and the life. Thanks be to God.